Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
8 on the Vineyard.
This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Hell hath no fury like America scorned. Just ask the Redcoats, Japan, and now the Taliban. Yet, for a country that has repeatedly stared down the enemy and won, America's foreign policy is often considered amateurish, even blundering. In this hour, how the winds, wisdom, and lucky breaks of America's past will likely guide the nation in the war on terror. But first, Attorney General John Ashcroft was in the hot seat today reporting to the Senate Judiciary Committee on his anti-terrorism initiatives. Josh Meyer, a reporter for the Los Angeles Times, was there, and I asked him what the senators asked and what the Attorney General said.
Well, he mostly summed up what he said before about it. He said that he's delicately trying to straddle the balance between aggressively countering terrorism, including future terrorist attacks, and also protecting the civil rights and liberties of Americans. He pretty much said again that if you're an illegal alien or somebody else who is not a U.S. citizen, you pretty much don't have any rights, essentially, particularly in the United States, if you're suspected of being a terrorist.
What was he asked? What was he pressed on by the senators? What were the most contentious exchanges?
Well, you know, we were expecting some fireworks, and there really were none. Senators Feingold and Schumer were questioning him, but the really aggressive questioning came not with regard to the terrorism policies of the Justice Department, but actually a news story that appeared today about how the Justice Department has refused to let the FBI check its records to determine whether any of the 1,200 people detained after September 11th had bought guns.
Just in brief, Josh, what is the point of the law that forbids tapping the database?
He didn't really have a good answer on that, except that's the way it was created, to protect the privacy of Americans. And there was some questioning of him as to, well, yes, but that doesn't protect the privacy of illegal aliens and or presumed terrorists who are on this FBI watch list. The FBI wanted to cross-match all of the people that it has in its crosshairs in terms of being suspected terrorists or even illegal aliens, and just run them, you know, across, reference them with that list to see if any of them pop up. And Ashcroft said that the only reason he couldn't do it was because it was against the law.
That would seem like something the FBI might want to do routinely in ordinary crimes as well.
Well, that's why we suspect the story showed up on the front page of certain newspapers today, exactly on the day that Ashcroft was supposed to be testifying before the Judiciary Committee. I mean, there was a lot of talk, mostly about the military tribunals as well. And nobody really pressed the Attorney General on what I think is one of the most important questions, and that is that in the wording of it, it says not only somebody suspected of committing a war crime, but anybody aiding and abetting or harboring a suspected terrorist. And, you know, that can mean almost anybody. I mean, if a terrorist sleeps on your couch for a couple of weeks, I mean, are you going to be before a military tribunal? I mean, I think there's a lot of questions, and I don't think the senators really got to the bottom of it today.
Do you have a sense that the senators are holding back because of the apparent public support for much of the program that Ashcroft has put forward?
I would never venture to say that the senators are guided by anything more than their principles, that polls showing tremendous American support for this would influence them in any way. But
they called the hearings today, after
right.
all.
Right. No, I mean, you know, the polls, I think, are 62% Americans in favor of what Ashcroft is doing. And I think, you know, I think that there was some speculation today, particularly among learned observers there, that some of the senators were cowed by the tremendous popularity of what Ashcroft is doing, and perhaps they didn't want to be suspected of being anti-American or unpatriotic or questioning the Attorney General during a time of war. And in fact, he even said that. He suggested in his prepared remarks that anybody who is sort of anybody who is questioning the what we're doing in the war on terrorism is aiding and abetting the terrorists themselves.
Ashcroft did bring his own bit of showmanship. He held up an Al-Qaeda terrorism manual at one point. What was the point of that gesture by the Attorney General?
Well, you know, it was a bit of showmanship, we think, but they also put it on their website today. But it's to show that these terrorists that they're searching, you know, are not your traditional criminals, and that they're people that will stop at all. It won't stop until they kill innocent Americans. You know, and what I think is the most interesting thing that came up today, as it has in the past, is you really do have an anomaly here in the sense that these people are, you know, they're not wearing military uniforms, but, you know, they could very easily be tried under the laws of war, mm-hmm. under war crimes, as they can under criminal law.
That is, alleged terrorists.
Right. So they're trying to sort all that out.
Was there any further information made public today about the Middle Eastern men being detained, maybe hundreds of people being detained?
No, I mean, and Ashcroft once again said that there's probably there's more than 500 people being held in custody, mostly on minor immigration violations, and that he didn't want to release their names because he didn't want to help out Osama bin Laden, in his words, by letting him know who we have in custody. I think one of the best exchanges was was when one of the senators, I think it was our own Specter of Pennsylvania, was sort of chastising Ashcroft for doing a lot of this without consulting the Judiciary Committee, which does have oversight over the Justice Department. And Specter said, you know, General Ashcroft, you know, I remember when you used to sit right next to me here on this very committee. And, and Ashcroft said, yes, it's a lot easier on that side. So, I mean, I think he was trying to say how hard it is for him to sort of balance aggressively going after terrorists with protecting people's civil rights and liberties.
Do you think the Attorney General changed any minds today with his testimony, with either the Judiciary Committee or the American public?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I'm not sure if it was really designed to do that. I think he basically wanted to show them that he, you know, is submitting to their attempts to at least exercise their oversight role over the Justice Department. But, you know, he said on several occasions that, you know, that they are just that. They're an oversight body, and that he has to make decisions that he feels are in the best interest of the American public. And he also said that there's times when he provides, you know, guidance to the President of the United States and to the Defense Department, and that he that's sort of a lawyer-client privilege, and that he won't discuss, even with the Judiciary Committee, what he's telling them. For instance, what his personal views are on the military tribunals, on whether or not you need a majority vote in a to convict somebody, or whether you need a higher standard of unanimity, I guess, if you want to impose the death penalty on somebody, whether you need a preponderance of evidence or some higher standard. I mean, all of those were discussed today, but I don't think I think everybody came into the to the hearing with their own views, and I think they left with those same views.
Josh Meyer is a reporter for the Los Angeles Times. He spoke to us from Washington. When terrorists attacked the United States, many Americans experienced profound anger they didn't even know was lurking inside. No Cause for Concern explains tonight's guest, American foreign policy scholar Walter Russell Mead. America is just getting in touch with its Jacksonian inner child. That's right, the brash fight-to-the-finish mindset of old hickory is taking root again, this time to fight the war on terror. What is your foreign policy for America in this time of crisis? Are you looking to the wisdom of Andrew Jackson, of Thomas Jefferson, or just George W. Bush? Join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us from New York is Walter Russell Mead, historian and author of the new book, Special Providence, American Foreign Policy and How It Changed the World. Good evening, Walter Russell Mead.
Good evening.
Thanks for joining us.
Good to be here.
And with us in the studio is our special coverage news analyst, Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
So, Walter Russell Mead, you talk about a special providence, a special aura of good luck and good fortune that surrounds American foreign policy. What's the evidence of that?
Well, here we are, a little over 200 years old. There have been, if you think of international politics as a game of risk, we're winning. The British had a world-spanning empire. The Germans, the Japanese tried to take it away. We got it instead. The Russians tried to take it from us. They failed. And now at this point, we probably have more power in the world than any country in world history.
I suspect that many Americans would kind of assume that that's because we had this huge resource-rich land and because of the intrinsic strength of our democratic tradition. But you're pointing to our foreign policy, where we might not have expected that you'd point. How has that brought us this great good fortune?
Well, for one thing, our land wasn't so rich and vast and extensive when we started out.
Mm-hmm,
we had Spain, France, and Britain, the three greatest powers of the day, all sort of on our case and trying to hem us in.
Mm-hmm.
Our first big victory that way came when we not only got Napoleon to sell us the Louisiana Purchase, but somewhat more with more difficulty got Britain to agree that we could keep it.
Mm-hmm.
Britain and France tried very hard to break up the United States in the Civil War. They were really looking for an opportunity to side with the South. If Lincoln's foreign policy hadn't been very astute, we could well have gotten into a much wider war there. So it isn't just a question of, you know, boy, we have Alaska, we have Hawaii, we have the continental U.S. Mm-hmm. We had to get it somehow, and it was success in foreign policy that had a lot to do with that.
And yet there's a kind of thread that runs through a lot of commentary abroad and in the United States that American foreign policy has tended to be sloppy and intellectually lacking somehow. Where's that come from if it's been so successful?
Well, you're right. That is the amazing thing, that there's no one in the world really who would challenge the idea that the United States is winning in world politics. But there's also an equally strong consensus that our foreign policy process is terrible. Half the time Congress is investigating the president. It's messy. It's sloppy. We can't keep secrets, which most people think is absolutely necessary to foreign policy. Everything the Secretary of State talks about to the president about is in the Washington Post the next mm-hmm. morning. Mm-hmm. So the assumption is, well, if the process is this terrible, then the policy itself can't be good. And then you do what Bismarck did, and you say, well, God must have a special providence for this crazy country because there's no other way to explain why they do so well.
For fools, drunks, and the USA. But you're not buying that. You're saying there's something else at work here. Give us a sense of what that is.
Well, what I've found is that in a funny way, our process the very messiness and sloppiness of our process may in fact get us to a foreign policy that over time and on the average is closer to the true national interest than the foreign policies that, you know, traditionally have been crafted by kind of isolated elites in other countries.
In monarchies and dictatorships.
Right, where you have this sort of, you know, multi-dimensional, multi-decade game of chess where Metternich advances his pawn here because he knows that seven moves later you'll be tempted to risk your queen and then he takes your knight and it's over.
But the literature of foreign policy would suggest, you know, that it's Machiavellian. You've got to be realist. You've got to be carefully calculating benefits and deficits. And you're describing a kind of a gangly, disorganized process that doesn't seem calibrated to fine calculation.
Right. And yet what I found as I kind of looked back at the history of American foreign policy, and by the way, one of the great myths in our country is that Americans didn't care very much about foreign policy before, say, World War II or at most World War I, whereas in fact all through our history foreign policy has played a huge role in our politics.
Explicitly or implicitly?
Explicitly. You know, what was the South's goal in the Civil War was to get British recognition. I mean, why was Pickett charging at Gettysburg so that the South would be aided by Britain? The William Jennings Bryan's Cross of Gold speech, right before the Cross of Gold, he says mm-hmm. it's 1776 again. Are we going to have the gold standard because England has it? In other words, are we going to continue a monetary mm-hmm. union with England mm-hmm. through the gold standard, or are we going to have an independent policy? The tariffs, all of these things. I mean, it's like, you know, you still will see it today sometimes. People will say to you, oh, Americans don't care about foreign policy, even though at the moment 50,000 people are demonstrating in the streets of Seattle about the WTO.
We're going to have to take a short break in a moment, Walter Russell Reed. But Jack Beattie, I want to bring you in before we do. Here it is, the argument that in spite of, or maybe because of, our crazy way of coming at this, we're making out like bandits.
Well, it may well be that this sausage making that goes into our domestic laws and has something similar in foreign policy, and that through it we create a kind of consensus. Our foreign policy has failed when that has failed. For example, in Vietnam, where the consensus that the government tried to put together did not hold up because the war was not as the government represented it. And that's a case where the messiness can actually reach in and change the policy, where the citizens for whom the policy is being done can say, no, we don't want it, and change it mid-course. And I'm sure to look at this from the point of view of a dictatorship, you'd say, this can't be. No nation could function this way, and yet we do and have.
We're going to come back after a break and dig into Walter Russell Mead's vision of American foreign policy, its history, and where it's headed, and ask, will this special providence still be with us in the new era we've supposedly entered? Since September 11th. What's your vision for American foreign policy? How close is the United States to it right now? Which approach do you prefer, schmoozy Clinton or butt-kicking Bush? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or join the conversation online at WBUR.org. Click on Special Coverage Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. We'll be right back. This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight about the lucky history of American foreign policy and how, our guest Walter Russell Mead says, it changed the world. Walter Mead is a senior fellow for the U.S. Foreign Policy at the Council on Foreign Relations. He earlier wrote Mortal Splendor, The American Empire in Transition. His new book is Special Providence, American Foreign Policy and How It Changed the World. Walter Mead, what about right now with everything that's gone on since 9/11? Do you still see that kind of blessed good fortune as wrapped around American foreign policy?
Well, good fortune, we'll see. You know, so far, so good, I suppose, in Afghanistan. But I do think that the traditional American foreign policy system, where there are four different ways of looking at the world that kind of compete, you know, four people trying to steer the boat in their own direction, wrestling at the wheel. We've seen it, that in that anger, that outburst of anger and determination to fight and to do it right away and to do it with everything it takes to win. This is a very good example of the Jacksonian America, as I call it, for Andrew Jackson. You saw it in a lot of the Indian Wars. You saw it when the South attacked Fort Sumter, that united the North. They'd fired the first shot, a cowardly attack is what people said.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, Pearl Harbor was another case. And when something like that happens, you get this kind of, in a way, we sort of as a society put ourselves under martial law almost immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And everything is about winning.
You do frame up this system in terms of four presidents, with Jackson being the one who doesn't take an offense like that lightly, and when the United States hits back, it hits back very hard. Take us through the other three, and then let's look at the current situation.
Okay, sure. Another important – well, they're all important. The Hamiltonian school, not a president, but close, is that he his view was that what the United States needed to do was to – integrate itself effectively into the world economy with government in a partnership with big business to advance the national interest economically. And then the money that we made as a society for that would ensure domestic political stability but also enable us to have the military resources to defend our interests.
Is that the overriding view of the 90s, of the 80s? Is there a recent time where the Hamiltonian view was prevailing?
Well, I would say the older George Bush was a pretty classically Hamiltonian president, and Clinton, for that matter, was sort of a split between that and the next school, the Wilsonian, you know, the sort of make the world democratic.
The League of Nations impulse, is that the do-gooder, global do-gooder?
That's right,
impulse?
Humanitarian intervention. Let's send the troops to bring democracy to Kosovo.
Or to put it more positively, the idealistic view.
That's right, although Wilsonians get very angry when you say that they're idealists. They say, no, because realistically speaking, American national interests will only truly be served when we have a world of democratic states accepting the rule of law, that ours is the most realistic way.
Ultimately, it sounds idealistic, but ultimately, that's the only way to go.
From a Wilsonian point of view, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So the Clinton administration was divided between Hamiltonian and Wilsonian. They would express themselves as saying, our goals are to expand free markets and free states.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have the sort of fourth school, which is kind of the more skeptical school, which I call Jeffersonian. And this is the classic home of the anti-war movement in American politics. And we had anti-war movements long before the Vietnam War. I mean, there was a tremendous anti-war movement in the Spanish-American War, the Mexican War, the Civil War itself in the North.
What was there about Jeffersonian thinking that fueled those movements?
Well, we've seen it too in this one. It's what are we trying to defend anyway? What makes America special? It's our liberty.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when we start locking up people without trial and military tribunals, aren't we losing the thing that we're fighting for? And there's a profound suspicion that getting ourselves involved in all these global adventures, either to extend democracy or extend free trade or what have you. Mm-hmm. Well, this, you know, Nader is I think,
Ralph
a
Nader.
Jeffersonian.
Mm-hmm.
Ralph Nader, mm-hmm. Yeah. Gore Vidal is another.
Pick that up. Why would you say Ralph Nader is a Jeffersonian in foreign policy terms?
Well, he looks at the Hamiltonian agenda of, you know, WTO, NAFTA. Classic Hamiltonian genesis. My God, this is a fundamental perversion. This is the U.S. government getting in bed with corporations against democracy and ordinary people, mm-hmm. which is just the kind of thing that Thomas Jefferson thought about Alexander Hamilton's plans.
Mm-hmm.
It's just what William Jennings Bryan thought of William McKinley. You know, it's a very old strain in American politics.
So there's the Hamiltonian looking out for our financial interest, Wilsonian, which is sounds more idealistic, but they say that's the only way to go. Jefferson, who wants to defend democracy in the United States by not getting too big a mess abroad.
Right, and not getting in bed with dictatorships and so on.
And the one you began with, and perhaps the one that's dominated this fall, the Jacksonian, which is if you mess with us, we will whoop you.
Right, exactly.
Jack Beatty, I want to bring you in here. I mean, I'm sure Walter Russell Mead will speak to this as well, but isn't it interesting how you can feel all four of these strands at once in the kind of symphony of American foreign policy responses? And I don't know about you, but even within myself, I feel myself responding to each of these. I don't know where I'd fall.
Right, and I think Mr. Mead does a really good job in his book of saying, you know, these are ideal types, and I'm boiling down here things that in human beings are just part. That's the fabric of ambivalence. I mean, certainly on China, I mean, who can look at China and not feel Hamiltonian? We have to change them through trade. And also Wilsonian. My God, we have to protest. We have to hold back our trade to protest the human rights record. Those things are going to exist in the same breast. But what I found really path-breaking here in this book, as I did in your article, Mr. Meade, when it first came out in the National Interest, was the mm-hmm. Jacksonians and bringing them in. And, you know, there's a whole view about American policy that it has been elites, Wilsonian elites and Hamiltonian elites, who've been making policy for which the sons of Jacksonians and daughters now have to go and die.
The best and brightest in Vietnam.
Yeah, I mean, Colin Powell calls them Kmart parents. And, you know, the people who make foreign policy, say the people in, as you show in the 90s, the people in the Bush administration who were going for free trade and so on, they were basically saying, well, you know, we'll sacrifice your jobs for our Hamiltonian ends. And then the Clinton administration in sending forces abroad, well, we'll sacrifice your sons to save the world. And now I hear a little bit of this Jacksonian, the elites using the anger and patriotism and valor of the Jacksonians in the way the elites now are saying, we've got to go into Iraq. Boy, we've got to, and you know, how many of those conservative columnists were in the military and how many have sons in the military? Very, very few. And I just really thought that your pages on the 90s were so evocative of really the struggle, part of the struggle today.
We're talking with Walter Russell Mead about his new book, Special Providence, American Foreign Policy and How It Changed the World. He posits that there are four big strains of perspective on foreign policy in United States history and still today, still at work in the war on terror. We're going to dig into that. What's your instinct? To hold hands or to knock heads? And has September 11th changed your outlook on the world? You can join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Walter Mead, hang on. I want to bring a call in before we go deeper. Christy's on the line. Hi, Christy. You're on the air.
Hi there.
Hi.
I was just calling to... I have a somewhat pedestrian view in the sense...
We doubt that.
You what?
We doubt that.
Well, I'm just in favor of the beauty of messiness in the sense that...
Of messiness.
Well, not because my house is messy. That's not a story. But the idea that the consent of the governed being the empowering force mm-hmm. of our country is something that I think is extraordinarily important in both domestic and foreign policy. And it gives a kind of power and I think an inspiration to others who look at it. For example, if you look at Vietnam, finally the consent of the governed said, you know what? This is the wrong place to be at the wrong time, and mm-hmm. we should get out.
Mm-hmm.
And we had to, you know, demonstrate and use various ways to do that. And I think that's what I mean about messiness. It's not easy. It's easier to have a dictatorship. This is what you're going to do. Mm-hmm. This is it. The Taliban says this is what you're going to do, and that's over. And so
So, Christy, right now, when the American public opinion polling overwhelmingly supports the tough guy approach to the world, or at least the terrorist harboring part of the world, you're prepared to say, yeah, let's go with that.
Yes, but. I think a lot of people are saying yes, but.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's been a very short time, and things are still very, very crisp and clear.
Mm-hmm.
And my next-door neighbor hasn't been hauled in unfairly yet.
Right.
To some, you know, military tribunal because he happened to be misidentified.
Mm-hmm.
And I think many people may experience those kinds of things. And so it goes from crystal clear to the way glass gets over time, a little bit cloudy, scratched, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not unpatriotic. In fact, it's very patriotic.
Walter Russell Mead, here's a caller embracing the very kind of messiness that you describe. And Christy, thanks for your call. But at the end of your research, Walter Mead, do you still see it as messiness, or is it this interplay of historical strands of perspective?
Well, if you wanted to sort of use theological terms, use it as God writing straight with crooked lines, that a process that doesn't, you know, that looks from moment to moment extraordinarily messy, and sometimes is really messy, Vietnam being a very good example. You know, there's some things we don't do well as a country.
Mm-hmm.
Limited wars are one of those. We can talk about that. That's may have some relevance to the topic tonight,
mm-hmm.
because the Jacksonian view of war is you fight all the bad guys with everything you've got, no quarter, unconditional surrender, total victory is your goal.
Mm-hmm.
If you can't fight the war that way, Jacksonians start to wonder at some point, then, why are we fighting? Why are you making our kids fight with one hand tied behind their backs so that we're taking casualties 100 a week, say, in Vietnam, because you're not, for some crazy political reason, going to bomb the Soviet tankers unloading in Haiphong Harbor or whatever it may be?
So it's all or nothing in order to protect the sons and daughters of America?
That Jacksonians really feel that, you know, a lot of people, for example, toward the end of the Gulf War, when the Air Force was just, you know, killing tens of thousands or whatever of Iraqi soldiers,
mm-hmm.
The world opinion was sort of horrified. But among American Jacksonians, the thought was, well, exactly, if you can kill them without losing any of your people, terrific.
Mm-hmm.
Why, you know, I mean, even if you think about it, even in the Revolution, you know, the British had all these ideas of, well, you should march in straight lines and no night attacks or sneak attacks, and the colonists wouldn't have any of that. This is about winning and about winning without dying. It's not about, you know, Marquis of Queensberry, elegant chivalry and jousting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but when you bring the Jacksonians in, Mr. Mead, you've got a problem, haven't you? Because they're going to, if you get them roused, they want to finish the fight.
Well, this is, you know, George Bush, the elder George Bush in his reelection campaign was faced with a very haunting bumper sticker. You know, Saddam Hussein still has his job. Do you? And, you know, that is a Jacksonian critique of the Bush, of the older Bush.
Well, and I suppose almost any American can feel in some part a resonance there. But yet you're saying the others respond to that and say, no, there are nuances here. You're overlooking Mr. Jacksonian.
Well, this, for example, I think what Bush, by the way, is trying to do is fight a Hamiltonian war, which is, although there are people in his administration who want a Jacksonian war.
Explain that, because Bush loves to strike the posture of the oil patch Jacksonian, doesn't he?
Exactly. But again, my reading of him is that he's less different from his father. He's better at it. You know, when his father said his favorite food was pork rinds, everybody just sort of laughed at him.
How ridiculous.
Right, exactly, you know, because he really is a Kenny Bunkporter.
Mm-hmm.
And the younger Bush is more convincingly Texan on the outside, but I think, you know, he's a preppy.
So what's the Hamiltonian agenda underneath the Jacksonian cowboy?
Well, we're never going to get this terrorism under control, for example, if we don't cooperate very effectively with the intelligence services and the money tracing authorities of other countries. And you can't make everybody do this.
Mm-hmm.
So, in fact, the coalition really does set political limits on how far and how fast we can go with certain aspects of the war. But he doesn't...
He doesn't let on, does he? He wants you to believe that it's fierce Jacksonian determination
here. I think he also knows, you know, he's on a tiger, and he has to ride the tiger. The September 11th roused Jacksonian opinion. Three American presidents have tried to fight limited wars since World War II. Truman in Korea, Johnson in Vietnam, and Nixon in Vietnam. And those limited wars wrecked all three presidencies.
Walter Mead, we have a caller speaking just to that point. We're at 1-800-423-8255, talking with Walter Russell Mead. Eric is on the line. Welcome, Eric.
Thank you very much. I feel that September 11th just crystallized my views. I do feel that America does do best in the what I would call the white hat, black hat wars. That is where you're easily able to see what the moral issues are. And Vietnam, they weren't so clear, and neither were they in Korea. But the fight we have on our hands now is very clear. The question is, can we stay the course? And can we follow through on our commitment to eradicating terrorism? And I realize that that moral dilemma is not always easy to find, but I do think that if we stay true to it, we will not necessarily win, but keep them on the defensive. I wonder what your thoughts are on that. And I would also say that I think that sometimes the government says one thing and takes it a while to come around. I am pleased that Hezbollah and Islamic Jihad have recently been put on our blacklist as terrorist organizations, and we seem to be following through.
Eric, thanks for your call. Walter Mead, there it is, this expression of the desire for the black and white, good-bad divide here. That has always made it easier for Americans when we can frame things that way, hasn't it?
That's right. You need a storyline. In the Cold War, Dean Acheson would say at the beginning when he was describing the Soviet peril to try to get everybody roused for the Truman Doctrine and the defense of Turkey and Greece from communism, he said he had to be, quote, clearer than truth about the nature of the Soviet peril. And there is a sense in which when you're trying to mobilize almost 300 million people for a long and difficult war, you need to lay down a fairly, pattern of what you're doing. And then you often get yourselves entangled. I often think that while we needed, in a way, as a society, that kind of myth of a united global communist threat led by Moscow to get the will to fight 40 years of Cold War, that's part of why we weren't able to recognize Red China. That's part of why we got stuck in Vietnam anyway.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, Walter Mead, we're coming on a break, but Jack Beatty, do you see this clearer than truth dynamic being put to work right now?
Well, Osama bin Laden took all that. I mean, no rhetoric, no exaggeration could compete with that. Dean Acheson, I think, in the same statement said, we have to scare hell out of the American people. We didn't need any government representation to scare hell out of us. The attack did it.
That was all taken care of. We're coming up on another break, but we're going to be right back. We're talking with Walter Russell Mead, he's author of the new book, Special Providence, American Foreign Policy and How It Changed the World. Do you still feel that special providence around this country in the wake of September 11th? We want to come back and look at that in particular. Is there a new dynamic that may change that blessed state? What's your vision for American foreign policy? And how close are we to it right now as the Taliban prepares to surrender as we talk about an ongoing war on terrorism? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight with Walter Russell Mead about American foreign policy, its unique history, and the strands of perspective on the world that have made it up. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Walter Mead talks about the Jacksonian view, the let's go kick some hinder, and then the Wilsonian view that says, "Oh, wait a minute, we've got to be to have enough idealism here that things end up in a better world." What's your instinct, to hold hands or knock heads? You can join the conversation, Walter Mead. We've seen, as you say, the Jacksonian view dominant in the couple of months since September 11th. But history would suggest, as you write it, that the other strands will emerge. If history holds true, how do you expect that those how have they been in play already, and how might they become more apparent as we go forward?
Well, I think you're already beginning to see some of it, because in order, you know, even if you're completely selfish and not idealistic at all, mm-hmm. you somehow need to look a little idealistic to get other people to support you, because mm-hmm. the cause of making America top dog in the world doesn't necessarily enlist a lot of eager supporters outside the U.S. Mm-hmm. And so I think you can see a lot of it being suddenly we're fighting for women's rights in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm. Very deliberately in speeches by George Bush and Laura Bush.
Well, it was as if Laura Bush had been, you know, wandering through the White House and found an old speech of Hillary Clinton sort of rolled up in a drawer somewhere and took it out and started reading it on the radio.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, those pictures in the newspapers and on TV of the women taking off the burqas and walking around actually, I think, did have a tremendous impact in Europe and elsewhere in terms of getting people to be somewhat more sympathetic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, before that, the only stories were about Afghan civilians being killed by American bombs. And then after that, it was Afghan civilians dancing and laughing in the street and playing kites.
The Jeffersonian view is the one, presumably, that George Bush and John Ashcroft feel most concerned about, because you know it's always out there waiting to break out in protest that the war effort is impinging on democracy and liberties here in the United States.
Well, I think the Jeffersonian view is always there. I don't think Jeffersonian anti-war movements usually win. I think you lose a war when the Jacksonians are alienated from the war. That if you really look at both Korea and Vietnam, while you had significant numbers of people more in Vietnam than Korea opposed to the war on Jeffersonian grounds, the real discontent was that Jacksonian opinions, again, said we're fighting this limited war, our boys are being murdered. Either mm-hmm. the war is important enough so we go in and win,
mm-hmm.
we bomb China, we do whatever we have to do, or if it's not that important, let's not fight it. And it is the danger of a Jacksonian alienation from the war that probably really keeps them up at night in the White House.
And how about the notion that things have changed since September 11th? Is it possible? I mean, your theory does interact with all the realities of the last 200, 250 years. Is it possible that global circumstances could be changing to such an extent that this old concert of impulses will no longer react with the world in the same way?
It could happen. It has certainly happened to other countries in the past. You can see, you know, Britain used to have a system that was similar to ours. In some ways, they still do. But, you know, this business, you know, Britain can't keep them divided on the continent anymore. France and Germany are together in Britain. Poor Britain doesn't know what to do. You could see situations where you could imagine situations where our reflexes didn't work in the world anymore. But to tell you the truth, I don't see them coming quickly.
Let's get one more caller in before we lose our time here. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Tom is on the line. Welcome, Tom.
Hi, is this me?
Yes, you're on.
Hi, great. I had a comment to add about after reading the recent McCullough book on John Adams, there, mm-hmm. there seems to be an Adamsonian approach, basically.
Give it to us fast,
well.
Tom.
Pardon me?
Give it to us fast.
Sure. It's that basically that democracy is the key issue, and that if you allow countries to develop democracies, you will make friends around the world. And if you somehow lose the ability to enable democracies, then you end up back in the Jacksonian, Hamiltonian kind of approaches to all these problems.
Let us take it from right there, Tom, and thanks for your call. How about it? Walter Russell Mead, and this comes to the fore in the Middle East where there's all the conversation about can we, should we, must we encourage democracy there. Is there another view?
Well, I would say that's a Wilson, what I call Wilsonian is what Tikaller just described as Adamsonian, but, you know, we can talk about labels all night long. But, yeah, this idea that, again, you'll hear it from a lot of critics of our current policy in the Middle East that by strengthening or siding with these dictatorial regimes, we're only making our own problems worse and lowering our own moral authority. And you can come at that from a Jeffersonian view, which is, well, so we should get out of the Middle East and just stop messing around there. Or the Wilsonian, more extroverted approach is to say, no, let's keep messing around there, but let's mess around there for democracy and not for oil or for whatever else it might be.
Walter Russell Mead, I wish we had two or three times as much time as we've got, but that's just about it tonight. We thank you very much for coming on with us.
Well, thanks for having me on the show.
Walter Russell Mead is author of the new book, Special Providence, American Foreign Policy and How It Changed the World. He's a senior fellow at the U.S. Foreign Policy at the Council on Foreign Relations. Jack Beatty, do you see something changing in the chemistry of the world that may shift the game a little bit here?
I don't know. I mean, it looked for a while in the 90s. You had Wilsonianism intervene for human rights and Hamiltonianism, free trade. This terrorism has put in a new and incalculable element. It's about irrational forces. It's about forces that can't be reached by the impulse, you know, the Wilsonian impulse, where we'll change them to a democracy and they'll love us. This is beyond any of that. So I think our old concepts here, we have to think anew to act anew, but our old concepts aren't going to they're not a grid to this new world as they were right up until the 90s, I think.
Walter Mead certainly gives us a great base to step off from in that consideration.
Indeed.
Listeners, for a comprehensive timeline chronicling the history of U.S. foreign policy, go to our website at wbur.org and click on Special Coverage. Jack, stand by for just a second. Attorney General John Ashcroft sat before a Congressional Judiciary Committee this morning and defended secret military trials, the detaining of foreigners, and his own privileged place with the executive branch. Today's hearing comes in the face of mounting criticism that the Justice Department is moving too fast and digging in too deep with anti-terror measures. Here's an excerpt of his testimony today before the Senate Judiciary Committee.
My day begins with a review of the threats to Americans and to American interests that have been received in the previous 24 hours. If ever there were proof of the existence of evil in the world, it is in the pages of these reports. Terrorist operatives infiltrate our communities, plotting, planning, waiting to kill again. They enjoy the benefits of our free society, even as they commit themselves to our destruction. Mr. Chairman and members of this committee, we are at war with an enemy that abuses individual rights as it abuses jetliners. We have responded by redefining the mission of the Department of Justice, defending our nation and its citizens against terrorist attacks is now our first and overriding priority. We have waged a deliberate campaign of arrest and detention to remove suspected terrorists who violate the law from our streets. Currently, we have brought criminal charges against about 110 individuals, of whom 60 are in federal custody. The INS has detained 563 individuals on immigration violations since September the 11th. The Customs Service and Border Patrol have been at their highest state of alert. All vehicles and persons entering this country are subjected to the highest level of scrutiny. Working with the State Department, we have imposed new screening requirements on certain applicants for non-immigrant visas. At the direction of the President, we have created a foreign terrorist tracking task force to ensure that we do everything we can to prevent terrorists from entering the country and to locate and remove those who are already here. Each action taken by the Department of Justice is carefully drawn to target a narrow class of individuals, terrorists, to those who scare peace-loving people with phantoms of lost liberty. My message is this: your tactics only aid terrorists, for they erode our national unity and diminish our resolve. They give ammunition to America's enemies and pause to America's friends. Our efforts have been crafted carefully to avoid infringing on constitutional rights while saving American lives. We have worked with Congress in the belief and the recognition that no single branch of government alone can stop terrorism. However, Congress's power of oversight is not without limits. Mr. Chairman and members of this committee, not long ago I had the privilege of sitting where you now sit. I have the greatest reverence and respect for the constitutional responsibilities you shoulder. I will continue to consult with Congress so that you may fulfill your constitutional responsibilities. In some areas, however, I cannot and will not consult with you. The executive branch is now exercising its core constitutional powers in the interest of saving the lives of Americans. I trust that Congress will respect the proper limits of executive branch consultation that I am duty-bound to uphold. I trust as well that Congress will respect this President's authority to wage war on terrorism and to defend our nation and its citizens with all the power vested in him by the Constitution and entrusted to him by the American people.
Attorney General John Ashcroft, today before the Senate Judiciary Committee. Jack Beatty, there was a lot of anticipation over the last 10 days that after the rigorous, severe new measures implemented by John Ashcroft and the Bush administration, that there was going to be some serious fireworks today in the Senate. And the report we heard earlier was that there really wasn't, that the senators appeared cowed by the intensity you hear in John Ashcroft's approach there and by public opinion supporting it. He said, "You're trying to scare Americans with phantoms of lost liberty, and that will only help the terrorists."
That, if I may just express a blunt personal opinion, that was a Nixonian statement. To say that people who are saying, let's make the war on terror consistent with the Constitution, are giving aid and comfort to the enemy, is as close to Richard Nixon as any statement made in American public life since his demise.
And for the half of our listeners who may not know what that means, Jack, the Nixonian...
It means your political opponents are really really traitors. That's what it says. Mm-hmm. You know, there can't be differences about policy.
No loyal opposition.
Loyal opposition here. And I'm just shocked that the senators didn't rise to that and say, what are you saying here? Are you saying that to talk about the American Constitution is helping bin Laden? This is zealotry, and I think we had a portrait of it, and it was a bad moment for the senators, I think.
We did have some concern expressed today. Here's a clip from Senator Ted Kennedy of Massachusetts pressing Ashcroft to describe the guidelines that will be used for military tribunals.
I'm profoundly concerned about the administration's broad plan on the military tribunals. President Bush's executive order is a broad proposal that has enormous potential for abuse.
Well, I am pleased to say that the President's order requires that there be full and fair proceedings. The President has ordered, and it is a military order, to the Department of Defense. It's out of his responsibility as Commander-in-Chief of a nation in conflict, that the Defense Department develop a framework that would provide full and fair proceedings. He's indicated that the hearings should be closed when it's in the national interest to close them.
Senator Ted Kennedy and John Ashcroft. Jack Beatty, look how courtly compared to John Ashcroft's just steamroller assertion of his program earlier in his own comments.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, he says full and fair proceedings in these military courts. You know, we've been hearing nothing for weeks now, but people sort of picking apart the ways in which they won't be full. People will not be able to have their own attorneys, for example, and they won't be fair. Juries can convict even two people on a jury out of five can be enough to convict for sentences of death. Doesn't sound like full and fair by the American constitutional standard, which isn't to say that we have to grant terrorists, you know, all the Marcus of Queensbury rules. But the dimension of this is we have to show the world that we can, you know, that we have a case to make against these people and that we can fight this war consistent with our tradition. He's saying throw the tradition out. And by the way, military people have come forward and say how drastically this plan differs from military courts martials, which have much more full and fair procedures.
Well, the top was not blown off today, but maybe at some point we'll have a more full and fair conversation about all these issues. Jack, great to be with you tonight.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston.